Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Side towards Sunreal, now Brisby. A chance now on the far side for Selvidge, and he scores! And Benny will go indeed for
ball. Hello and welcome to the Football History Podcast. Change of brand, but not change of content, dear listeners. That opening montage was, of course, the for anyone of a certain generation, the highly distinctive opening bars of the big match theme, the highlight of every weekend for any boy of a certain age. And joining me to look at the formative years of televised football is a boy of a certain age himself. It's Mr. Neil Andrews. How are you doing, Neil?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I've been on a nostalgia fest. We've been planning this show for a long while, listeners, and I hadn't done much prep for it, in true. I know it so well, the big match being brought up on Sunday afternoon football on ITV. And then actually there's quite a lot to the show, which, you know, only by watching some of these old shows do you realise what a foreign country the past is sometimes, Neil. The ITV player is a wonderful resource if you're interested in looking at the current series, which is featuring the 1980 to 81 series of the Big Match. Do have a look. But let's begin, Neil, by outlining what the Big Match was. It was, for me, it was always the highlight of every weekend, but it was the ITV football show, the equivalent of Match of the Day, wasn't it?
I don't know. I never watched it.
You never watched the Big Match?
No, I'm joking. Yeah, it was actually the 80-81 season is the interesting one, because that's when it moved to Saturday night.
Yes, it did.
Moved to Sunday, yeah. Everyone was thrown off kilter, weren't they? Because their weekend had kind of gone for a burn, because you used to watch Match of the Day on a Saturday evening. In between Parkinson and whatever horror film they were showing. And then on the Sunday, you know, just before your Sunday dinner, you used to watch the Big Match. And
the golden shots and the like. Yeah. And we just explain to youngsters, I mean, we live in a very different televisual era with so much choice that sometimes you lose all sense of discretion and taste with what you're watching. But certainly back then we were very limited, and ITV was structured, Neil, in a very different way. It was kind of an umbrella of local television stations. In London, Thames Television was weekday service, and then at weekends you had the opening bars that you heard at the start of the show, which was the London weekend theme, and that always led into the classic Big Match theme. But local TV, it was a very different idea, a very different structure, and the London television football television match was the Big Match, featuring Brian Moore, of course, a classic voice of the past.
Yeah, so obviously typically the feature match always had a London club on it. Invariably it was Tottenham or Chelsea. Yeah, they would go to West Ham. However, you know, to be fair to them, that, you know, they would dip in, they'd show Leighton Orient, they'd show Millwall. You know, they'll show Charlton Athletic, you know, no matter what division they're in. You know, there's some great footage of games from the third division featuring Charlton. You know, there's footage from, you know, Leighton Orient when they were challenging to go up, and in the FA Cup with John Jackson in goal. You know, there's a great game, you know, when they're playing Man United on the first game of the season when Man United was in the second division, and the crowd was immense, you know. But then you know, you'd get action from elsewhere. And they usually always told you where it was from. So, you know, from Granada Television, it's Liverpool versus whatever, or Tyne Tees, it's from, you know, they'd always tell you where the pictures were from.
Which TV company supplied it.
Yeah. And it was kind of, you know, it's interesting to look at it now and compare it to the current match of the day. And there's no competition. You know, all they do is, you know, here's the game, here are the goals. You know, they'll interview the managers afterwards, usually together. Maybe interview a couple of the players, run through some of the talking points. But, you know, that was it. But, you know, the game was not obscured by pointless facts. You know, there was no, you know, the camera angles that, you know, would give you a headache. There was no zooming in or whatever. It was just, you know, pure, unfiltered football, which...
Very different era. I mean, even the construction of the television service with local stations covering different regions of the country. So that meant that you, wherever you lived in the country, you had a good chance of seeing, certainly on ITV, your club featuring. I think they had a contractual obligation to show a certain number of lower division games. So that's how Millwall, for example, speaking from our own perspective, would feature so often on the big match. I mean, it's a London club, obviously, and they had to show, they couldn't just show first division football all the time. It was not like Sky TV TNT have it now. So we would often feature on there, as you say, as would Charlton, as would Orient, and whether they were Languishing Palace.
It's funny that you should mention that, because I think it's the end of the 77-78 season. Or was it the season before? It was the season Notts Forest sneaked into the promotion spots under Brian Clough and, you know, sliding
like,
ball.
Yeah, like 77.
And the main game was Wolves versus Bolton, and Bolton had to win to go up. You know, and that was from the second division. And then you had, I think it was Colchester United in the fourth division, you know, their kind of promotion push. And, you know, and then you had someone else. There wasn't a first division game featured. But the names you'd hear, you know, names of the past, you know, you would hear, you know, stars of yesterday, stars of tomorrow, and all sorts. You know, and one of the sad things about watching this is how many players have died, you know, recently. Yeah. You know, you watch it, you know, I was watching last week, and, you know, Ray Kennedy scored. You know, he's gone, you know, and then you go to Southampton, you know, you got Alan Ball, he's gone, and kind of thing, you know, and then even Tommy Caton, who died when he was 30, you know, being described as a hot prospect. So there is a sad element to it. And in my own morose way, you know, especially in the kind of mid to late 70s, you look at the crowds and you think, you know, how many for them, the highlight for them was, you know, they would go to the match on the Saturday, maybe go out at, you know, Saturday night, have their Sunday, and they're back at work Monday in whatever steel factory they were working at or what have you. I know that sounds very, you know, northern and what have you. Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, this is the highlight of their working week, and it got no better. And it's quite sad in that context, you know, when you put it in the context of the 70s. But, you know, the football, you know, they don't lose their mind over it. You know, you see some great goals. You see some really good touches. You know, there was a great goal the other week from Gordon Hill, you know, hit it on the volley that, you know, Messi did it now, be hailed as a new saviour once again, or, you know, stuff like that. And it's like, there's no hyperbole around it. You know, like,
no, I was struck by that. The episode I watched today, listeners, it's on ITVX if you have the app on your iPad or your device or whatever you've got. And the current series is 1980-81, which, as Neil has said, was the first season where the big match, which is traditionally a Sunday afternoon show, had won the Saturday night. So I think that was felt to be the glamour spot, the more substantial slot, I think, Match of the Day traditionally occupied it. But the big story in the game that I watched today was Southampton beating Manchester City, 1980, I think, first game of the season. And there was a number of references to the problems within the game. I mean, by that they mean football hooliganism, which was probably going to approach its zenith in the mid 80s, but certainly at this point in 1980, it was a constant factor in going to football. But that said, you know, the game was attractive. You had players like Kevin Keegan had just come back from his sojourn in West Germany with Hamburg, I think it was. And he had him alongside Mike Shannon, Neil, and Dave Watson at centre half, and Manchester City had goalkeepers like Joe Corrigan in goal. These were substantial players that probably could have, and some did, make England caps. But you know, they were not Shannon apart, maybe, and Keegan. They weren't regulars, and yeah, they were on just a regular Saturday afternoon. There was a different feeling of localness. I don't know if that's a word, but it, you know, Southampton was a small club. It wasn't the big stadium it has now. The Dell was quite tightly packed, and there was a happy atmosphere in the ground. At odds with the way it was being described as a chance, you know, the almost like the game was dying slightly.
Yeah, you know, because Kevin Keegan was footballer of the year at the time. So you know, they were always looking for positives. You're right, you know. They would report on the incidents of crowd trouble every week. They'd also report on, you know, managers going out to draw a game and get a point, you know, and not playing attractive football and, you know, playing the offside trap and getting criticised for it and things like that. So it's an interesting perspective in that way. You know, and English football was in the doldrums, you know. They hadn't qualified for a World Cup since 1970. You know, so it was kind of like, the 80s was the bright new era, wasn't it? You know, the shorts were getting shorter. The kits were getting a bit more glamorous. You know, it wasn't as dour as, you know, should we say, some of the 70s games. But it's really interesting when you go through, you know, the games and the seasons, as it were, you know, especially if you don't know the results. You know, I still get great satisfaction. There's a great game between Sunderland and West Ham where West Ham get absolutely roasted 6-0.
That's always good to watch.
That's a fantastic game. And then there's, you know, there's worse games where they actually win. But, you know, it's kind of, you know, some of the goals, some of the names that you see, you know, these are the names that were appearing in those football annuals you had at the time. You know, it brings back this warm, fuzzy glow of nostalgia. Innocence, as it were. And it's funny that as it creeps to the late 80s and early 90s, you suddenly start, you know, fearing the worst. It's going to change now, you know. It's going to go the other way. It's going to lose its momentum, you know. It's not going to have Saint and Greavesy around anymore and all this, and it's not going to have Brian Moore except in the commentary box, and you know, pundits are going to start coming more to the fore, and you know, first they're behind a desk, now they're all sitting around in comfy chairs and giving their expert opinion. It's like, yeah, we can see where that ball went. It hit the net. Why it hit the net, it doesn't matter. It hit the net. Why are you analysing it 100 times in different ways, you know? You know, and did the referee make a mistake? Yes, the referee made a mistake. And, you know, they criticise refs. They don't crucify them. But, you know, they point out mistakes. And, you know, but at the same time, they also point out mistakes by their own players. I remember Brian Clough, Palace versus Forest, I think a couple of seasons before the current series, where Peter Shilton let one through his legs and Brian Clough hadn't realised. And he told me, I said, oh, he let through his legs, did he? Oh, well, that's going to live forever, isn't it? You know, he's very astute in that respect, you know, that he can make 100 saves and, you know, makes one mistake and he'll be
judged on his error.
Yeah, and it's like, it's that kind of nuance and that kind of insight that I think is missing from the game today.
I think it had perspective. Yeah. I mean, this was the I suppose you'd say the big match and to some extent match of the day, but I think the big match and the ITV coverage probably led the way with the development of what you might call personality footballers. There's a famous interview, I was watching it before we came on, actually, the Malcolm Allison and Terry Venables after a game. I think Palace had beaten, I think it was Manchester City who Allison was managing at the time.
Man City beat them. So,
Allison was
out of work. I watched that. Allison was out of work and they had a caretaker in charge. They were bottom of the division and they hired Allison a few weeks later, but he had been in charge of Man City and been fired. But yeah, you're right about the interview when, you know, they're both
there. But in the dressing room, Neil, I think that was what struck me. I mean, they were clearly friends off the pitch, friends, and I dare say they enjoyed a drink and all the rest of it. But there they are in the Crystal Palace, I imagine, dressing room, sat next to each other, having a laugh. They were talking about incidents in the game. I think Joe Corrigan had made an error to concede a goal. And it wasn't seen as life and death. It was seen as a game of football where, you know, you don't have to finish up hating each other at the end of it. It was a very different atmosphere and slightly at odds with this rising The Jim Rosenthal does a roundup in one episode, the 80-81 series, where he just casually mentions, oh, yes, there was a riot at Sheffield Wednesday against, I can't remember who, they were protesting at the ownership of the club. So on the one hand, you've got this kind of nascent hooligan tribalism, I suppose, that we see nowadays, and also there was a kind of a perspective on how the game should be seen on the other in the TV presentation. Interesting, you know, double approach in a sense, but certainly it helped develop personality like Malcolm Allison, Terry Venables, quite a few of the bigger names at the time made their names by being a pundit on the big match.
I felt the crowd was tremendous, and I hope they really enjoyed us, which I think was an excellent game.
What was your verdict overall, Terry?
Well, like you said, it was written up to be a great game of attacking teams, young players, everything that's good in the game, and I was just pleased that it even surpassed that. I thought the football at times from both sides was absolutely superb. Mm.
What did you feel about the first goal, Malcolm? I mean, it was a strongly hit shot by Ian Walsh, but, I mean, what did you feel about Joe Corrigan's part in it?
Well, Joe was disgusted with himself, but I think that he was so disappointed when the ball went through his hands that he didn't recognise that if he'd have turned, he could have just put his hand on the ball and it wouldn't have been in the net, which is very unusual for Joe because he's got very, very good reaction. He's a very alert guy and a tremendous trainer, a good professional. And he was just absolutely frustrated and disappointed with himself.
Yes, because it was amazing because there was so much good goalkeeping right through that that one incident should spoil it.
He was falling and he went to catch it. He's got beautiful hands and he just went through them.
I'm getting worried.
Do you feel talking about another incident that maybe a penalty early on in the game, which looked as though it was a penalty to you, that might have turned the whole thing?
I'm not allowed to say anything.
That was quite funny because we had a little interchange there. He'd jumped up because he thought it was a penalty, and of course the player reacted as well, and he said to the referee, "No penalty," and he got his name taken. So I said, "Here, you've just got, you've just taken his name for him." So he said, "I'll find him Monday."
But your feeling was, you're entitled to an opinion, for heaven's sake.
No, we're not entitled to an opinion, but I think he was tripped in the penalty area.
Terry Venables and Malcolm Allison.
I think, you know, there's a brand of perspective as well. You know, everything in the Premier League is shiny. And this is not a criticism of the Premier League per se. But, you know, it went for a rebranding when the football's meant to be different. The football's not much different from, you know, you watch some of these games and they're absolute classics. You know, there's goals flying in both ends and they're really good goals, you know. And, you know, if you've got a boring 0-0, what livens it up? A good punch up between the players or, you know, a scrappy goal or the goalkeeper dropping it? Yeah, you know, but I think people forget it's an entertainment business at the end of the day. But, you know, these days, you know, you listen to pundits and someone, I read somewhere, you know, someone was spot on. I can't remember, I read it in a magazine or, you know, read it in a newspaper or something. But they were saying, you know, the joy of listening to Andy McCoist as such is because he just really enjoys watching the game of football, you know, and just really gets enthusiastic about it. And he doesn't try to come across as one of these pseudo-intellectuals who tries to read into the games and the philosophy. He just enjoys watching it and says, oh, that's a great pass, rather than, oh, yes, he picked him out there and, you know, that's what you get, you know, with hours of expertise, blah, 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 et cetera. And it's like,
I suppose you'd throw Roy Keane into that kind of McCoist
school
of punditry, because again I know he puts on the poker face, but you do get a sense that he enjoys watching football, which doesn't always come across very well. There's a wonderful interview, I mean it's done the rounds plenty on the net, a big match interview between Alan Mullery and Malcolm Allison. But Mullery was a player still.
Yeah, I remember that one. The absolutely brutal
assessment of his skill or lack of by Malcolm Allison. I mean, you don't know if you get that nowadays where a player sits with a leading manager and 1v1. Well, I think Jimmy Hill was the mediator, if you want, whilst Allison actually takes apart Alan Mullery's limitations as a midfielder, comparing him with the world class that he said he wasn't in that world class category.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's such a different time in that way, because you just wouldn't do that now, would you?
It's, you know, the other thing is, you know, they used to interview all the young players once they made a debut, and they've not had any media training. And it's very young and what, you know, very naive. You know, some talk better than others, some are more eloquent than others, you know, but you can see, you know, some of them are just, you know, these youngsters from school, and you can really see that, you know, you know, they've worked their way up, and, you know, they've been given a chance. But they had Danny Wallace on, making his debut for Man United at Old Trafford. And the reason was that a load of players went down with flu and he didn't know who was playing. And in the interview, he said, yeah, Laurie told me. And Laurie McMenemy turned around and went, Mr. McMenemy to you. that kind of thing, you know, in jest. But, you know, it's kind of a world away from the kind of, I know you've got to be more media savvy now, but, you know, they all just seem really enthusiastic about wanting to play football. You know, there's nothing money related or nothing money orientated into a certain extent. You know, you get, you know, the breaking news of players going to the clubs. I mean, in this season of the big match, you know, the beginning, it was all about Alan Clark going to Leeds from Barnsley, you know, and how he was going to be the saviour of Leeds United. Yeah, that worked out well. But, you know, it's kind of the interesting thing is knowing what happened to him with perfect 2020 hindsight. That's fascinating. How they were seen, you know, and how they were perceived at the time. Especially the younger players coming through, like Ray Wilkins. You had a few others, you know. I remember Clive Walker playing for Chelsea. You know, I remember him scoring, you know, goals in the FA Cup against Liverpool. They were quite famous. And Ray Clements having an absolute howler. But it also highlights the shortcomings of players that are, in my view, really overrated, like Phil Neal. And this is going to get loads of abuse, because I always get loads of abuse when I mention this. But everyone goes, look at his trophies, look at his England caps. And I always say, watch the big match, go on YouTube, watch England game. And look how many times Phil Neal is responsible for a goal. It's more than you realise. Some of it is astounding defending. It's just, you know, you think, how the hell did this guy win 50 caps?
You know, I suppose. I mean, it's interesting you say, you know, Phil Neal, part of the Liverpool side. Yeah. The episode I watched today featured the lead match was Southampton versus Manchester City. But the I think the secondary game was Palace at Anfield. Liverpool were the reigning champions. Yeah. In the 80-81 season. And just to, I don't know if it answers the point that you're making about Phil Neal, but the Liverpool side looked like a machine, like the mothership coming to land in one of these alien kind of domination movies, where no matter what you do, you were going to get beaten by this Liverpool side, with fronted by Kenny Dalglish, who incidentally scored a goal. Listen, if you want one difference between now and then, he scores a goal and makes it, I think, 2-0 for Liverpool. Palace lost the game, but he was clattered in there's a header, unusually perhaps for Kenny Dalglish, but he headed it home, batted on the head, and I think the referee comes and talks to him for a minute or two. He shakes his head, stands up and runs back to the centre. No kind of concussion protocol or leaving the pitch or anything of that kind. He was just back into it. And they mentioned at half time, he was a little bit shaken up by that. He's still on the pitch.
Yeah, there was a few like that, you know. There was a famous one. There was a Wolves player who came on and broke his leg with his first tackle, you know. Right. And there's a few serious injuries there. You know, it highlights some of the good things that have changed, like the concussion protocols, etc. Some of the kind of, you know, taking precautions. You know, in certain aspects, the game has changed for the better. In terms of the atmosphere, the stadium, and the pitches themselves, that's changed for the better. But, you know, you don't get that element of chance with a bobbly pitch like you did at Derby County, which it kind of, you know, detracts as well. But it's, yes, we can wallow in nostalgia, but at the same time, you know, sometimes you forget just how good football was in the past, and how good certain players were, because it gets lost these days, you know, when they talk about the greatest players of all time. You rarely get anyone mentioned from the 70s or 80s in England, which is really unfair.
Forgotten era. Yeah. Funnily enough, you say nostalgia. This is, I was trying to do a few notes for myself, listeners, and one of my notes was two middle-aged blokes. I think I might be stretching it to call myself middle-aged now, Neil, but two middle-aged blokes getting nostalgic over the 1970s. That was my subtext for the conversation with Neil. I think we're probably nailing that at the moment. Yeah, I mean, pitches. I mean, the Southampton pitch was in good nick. I think it was some coverage.
Because it was the beginning of the season.
Some coverage from Tottenham. I think it was Tottenham, White Hart Lane. It was half of it was sand. You know, it was just like sanded all over. And yeah, a bit of patch of grass with a huge expanse of sand on it. And that was how football was played. And somehow these.
Here's a really geeky one. There's, if you look at the Liverpool pitch at Anfield, there's loads of squares over it, small little squares. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember, it was the season after, the season before. I think it was the season after. They had a real problem with their pitch to the point that I think Liverpool were thumped 3-0 by Man City. I think it was the season after at home at Christmas, and they were somehow 18th in real relegation trouble, and it was the pitch. And after that, they went on this run, but they didn't lose a game, and they ended up winning the title. It was an amazing mm-hmm. run, but it was like you just look at the standard of the pitch, and yeah, you would never get that today. But you're right, you know. But I don't know whether that is a good thing or a bad thing. You know, everyone.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Rackney Marshes, so, you know, even a professional should.
I mean, I suppose it's a good thing. Yeah, what struck me watching, I mean, there's loads of this, the episodes on YouTube, listeners. You can go to ITV and they've got like a curated season at the moment, 80, 81, as I said, but there are others if you subscribe to their premium. So, but there's loads on YouTube. You don't have to go to that app for it. There's loads on YouTube, loads of clips that people have lifted over the years as well. It's just a different... a different world. I mean, another thing that struck me today watching Southampton, and we're wearing a Patrick broad stripes reversed Ajax style shirt, red and white. No adverts on the shirts. No sponsorship.
They weren't allowed to on TV.
No. Neither Manchester City. Nor, both in just plain shirts. It kind of, and you know, it's surprising how quickly you get used to that, and you think, oh, there's nothing unusual about it, as it should.
Well, it was the rules then, wasn't it? So they could have shirt sponsorship, except when on live TV, which caused a few problems every now and then. But I always get fascinated by reading the advertising hoardings running around the pits.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Collins Jeans of the High Street, you know, come get your jeans now.
There's a timber merchant, Southampton timber merchants. Yeah, get your 4x2 here, you know.
And as we've discussed in the past, you know, there's always a steel manufacturer like, yes, I really fancy 100 weight of steel on the way home. I will go there. Yeah,
steel manufacturer and TV rental services, so you could go and hire your television. No one bought a TV back in the 70s, did they?
TV rentals. Yeah, I wrote an article for Nutmeg magazine, I think it was last year or the year before, when I was looking at all the advertising in Scotland, and there was a surprising number of adverts for alcohol. seven different brands of whiskey or beer. So, you know, they really knew their audience, kind of thing. But yeah, it's something like, you know, is that fish and chip shop still there? You know, it's kind of things like that. It's just fascinating. It's a completely different world, you know, seeing signs for Coca-Cola and, you know, Kodak, and at Millwall is the Lady Whore Trust behind the
Support the Lady Whore Trust, whatever that was, some charity of some sort. I mean, other things that strike you apart from the pitches, I suppose the heaviness of the balls, which you're not really aware of watching the coverage, but of course that's come to come into controversy nowadays with the sad amounts of Alzheimer's that's being detected as a result of heading footballs back then. Great goal by Mike Shannon, headed, but I mean you do watch them with different eyes now, Neil, because you think, God, what are you doing to yourself by Dave Watson heading with power out from defence, and think what you're doing to yourself, you know.
Dave Watson scored a great goal for Man City, header from the edge of the box, and it was rocket with a header. And as soon as I saw that, it was just after his diagnosis, you think, you know, there for the grace of God go I.
Yeah.
But yeah. The other thing that always fascinates me is the trend in the, should we say, the success of different teams, or, you know, how... near to the title certain teams got. So, you know, you had Stoke City, you had QPR, you had Manchester City, you know, you were driving for the title, you had West Bromwich Albion, et cetera, you know, good teams that could actually challenge. And that's something that you don't see these days. Yeah, Leicester City apart. You're seeing it kind of, strangely enough, this season, you know, Aston Villa, you know, making a nuisance of themselves, kind of thing. You know, you've had Wolves in the past, et cetera, making a nuisance of themselves. But, you know, these were genuine teams with decent players who were having a serious tilt at the title. And obviously this season, I think, comes down between Villa and Ipswich Town, doesn't it? But, you know, it's like you forget how strong these players are. So when, you know, they talk about a top of the league clash between West Brom and Man City in the 1970s, I think it's a real reminder that, you know, Man City weren't always awful. They weren't always in the second division.
No.
You know, they were AD Sidon, you know, the Stoke City one, you know, the reason why they went downhill was because, you know, the wind blew the roof off their stadium and they didn't have insurance, so they had to sell the players.
Didn't have any insurance, very 70s, very 70s thing, isn't it? It's a fascinating, if you like football, if you like social history, really, I mean, to see the fences today, it does take you aback a little bit. You realise that was once was normality around the side of a football stadium to have a fence to keep the crowd in. Obviously, that would come to a tragic end as the 80s would wear along. I think the story of the big match, Neil, is, I mean, it's a story of football in some ways, story of society, because we've gone from, it begins in 1968, fronted by Brian Moore, who had a very polished, almost like an uncle kind of quality to him. Like everyone's uncle was Brian Moore somehow, reassuring, you know. Begins in 1968, he fronted it until 1983, when he would move on, I think, just to the commentary role. Then he'd go to Elton Wellesby, and then finally, most recently, Mark Pugach, apparently. I haven't seen him doing it.
It changed, didn't it? Because ITV stopped being so regionalised.
If you move away from the regional idea gradually into ITV being a national TV company.
Because Brian Moore was always the commentator as well for...
He presented and commentated.
But, you know, whoever decided to put this on during lockdown was an absolute genius, because it got the viewing figures, etc. But then people started complaining it was London orientated. So they put, I think it was Star Soccer or something like that, the Granada version, so the Northeast.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, the difference in quality of production values is astonishing. You know, you joke about how different it was, you know, especially in the late 70s, early 80s kind of thing. But even the opening titles were naff. You know, whereas the big match had great opening titles, this had, you know, local football players putting on their shirts in the gym. And the studio was kind of like plywood. It was like a Monty Python, you know, spoof of a football studio. But even then, you know, you've got the football and, you know, it was interesting to see it so focused on the North East kind of thing. So, you know, and you get the same thing now. We go to LWT and, you know, this game.
ATV was the Birmingham one, wasn't it? And Tyne Tees from the North East, and Granada was... and Yorkshire TV. So each area of the country had its own television company, and they produced their own TV show. So they would often, the big match would often begin, obviously, with the London game, and they'd borrow some of the coverage from Granada, right? ATV, depends whether the result and the most attractive game was. So, and gradually, as it would change, as football would change, live television would come in, and it would, you know, it became the match. Behind the big was lost, and it became the match. And gradually it lost its purpose and personality, I suppose, as it would wear along now.
They used to have one live game on a Sunday, didn't they? And they used to show highlights.
Sunday afternoon,
You know, they showed the goals from every other First Division game, which was good. But again, even Sunday afternoon, you wouldn't have the same kind of punditry you would now. You know, Jimmy Greaves may be there, and St John may be there, you know, and they'd give honest opinions and, you know, insight, have a laugh, you know. It wasn't slick. I mean, it was far from casual, but, you know, it was meant to be, you know, like talking with your mates in the pub. But, you know, if you look back on some of the other, you know, the Christmas editions and things like that, there's quite a famous, you can see on YouTube actually, a game between Burnley and Millwall from Christmas
3-1.
And, you know, it's so slick and professional that they missed the opening goal. And then which was a Hazel free kick.
They missed
that go into the back of the net. And then the second Millwall goal. Gerald, since that opening minutes, I have no idea who got the final touch. And it's like, it was John Seisman, And actually, Elton John was presenting. He had to tell the viewers it was John Seisman who got the, you know, final touch of the goal. But, you know, it's kind of, you kind of miss that because, you know, yes, everyone likes to see all the goals and what have you, but, you know, there's an honesty about it. You know, I don't know who scored that goal. Whereas today, you know, it's kind of like that they would say this or say that, and, you know, it just got to be.
Yeah, you'd have camera angles coming out of your backside, you know.
Ironically, for a podcast, you know, but in today's world, you know, you've got to keep talking because they think the viewers will switch over. You know, and it's amazing how everyone used to watch the BBC for Motson and Davis, and, you know. But I think, yeah, as you grow up, you realise that probably Brian Moore was the better commentator.
Well, yeah. Imagine if they seem to have a rightly or wrongly, I think possibly wrongly, had a kind of a gravitas that the big match never seemed to quite have. I think BBC back then had some sense of national kind of heavyweight kind of equality, which ITV was always seen as kind of midweek razzle entertainment. Yeah. You know, it wasn't seen as quite the authoritative thing that the BBC was.
So, I mean, to be controversial, you know, as Match of the Day's gone on, you know, I can't listen to Jonathan Pearce. There's no way I can listen to Jonathan Pearce when he's commentating. But even John Motson became, you know, and I'll probably get crucified for saying this as well, he kind of became a parody of himself, if that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, in
that,
yeah.
You know, he started to live up to his spitting image puppet kind of thing. and, you know, now, you know, they just keep talking and they just keep talking and talking and talking. And then you get the co-pundits who just keep talking and talking. Now, Ron Atkinson used to do that, to be fair. But, you know, as Barry Davis said, the trouble with Ron Atkinson, he would say something spot on, but it'd be lost because he'd just...
In amongst all the guff. Yeah.
But, you know, these days you get all the talking, but you don't get the insight. And then you get, you know, people coming up with phrases like, oh, turnover, and, you know, oh, they got caught in possession and this and that and whatever status. So I don't care. I can see that. You know, I don't need you to kind of dumb it down for me.
In contrast to the Match of the Day, which has always had the same theme tune, the big match had no fewer than 6 theme tunes, Neil. The classic one, which I remember well, and I can't play it, listeners, for fear of copyright, but I'm going to hum it for you. The first one was 1968 to 72. It's called The Young Scene by a groovy artist by the name of Keith Mansfield. And that went... bop, bop, bop. 68 to 72. That was The Young Scene. You can tell how groovy it was by that.
You won't be stupid because no one would ever recognise that rendition.
I'd forgotten this one. I had to listen. It was a very forgettable tune. 72 to 73. Cheeky Bird. I'd never heard of it, and I can't even hum it to you because it made no impact on me. A composer called Don Harper. Then the other classic one, which if you said to me big match, I probably would come out with the one that we played at the start of the show, a few bars. La Soiree, The Evening by David Ordini.
Actually, they're my ringtone.
Dun, 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 yeah. Dun, 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 dun.
That is my ringtone.
And strangely, 1980, they went to a song called Jubilation by a quite famous artist, Jeff Wayne. I didn't know he'd written the big match theme.
Yeah, it got released as well. Actually, there's a great site. I think it's called Football 45 RPM, I think it's called.
Right.
And this bloke has, he only goes on the website if he's got the vinyl in his hand. He has got the most astounding collection of football vinyl. He must have thousands. I'll tell you what, there are some bangers on there. And when I say bangers, I mean absolutely atrocious records. You know, like not just Kevin Keegan head over heels. You've got Franz Beckenbauer, Claudio Chiniglia. Anyone that was anyone has obviously released the song.
But, you know. He might have every football theme song on planet Earth now, but I'm just wondering, does he have a female relationship at all, mate? That's my question. Jubilation. I can try and sing that one for you.
It was when they started, they also changed the titles. The titles went from the traditional kind of overlay to computer graphics. So
it was losing it by this was like the start of the kind of the loss of grip Jubilation by Jeff Wayne, who had achieved fame as with his War of the Worlds overblown number that sells out the O2 Arena now regularly. If you want to make a fortune, stage Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds at the O2 and it sells out. You could set it out for weeks and weeks, like Prince or something.
Jeff Wayne's The Big Match.
I didn't even know it.
With a hologram of Brian Moore on the stage.
There was then a song called, or a tune called Aztec Gold by an artist called Silk Road.
Yeah,
impact on me whatsoever.
86 World Cup thing, and they kept it. Everyone knows that. It's that one with the jingly bells. The interesting one about that was Colour Box did a World Cup thing for them.
Right.
And on the cover, they had Jimmy Hill. And ITV said, yes, we'll have this, but you'll have to change the cover. And they refused to change the cover. So they just released Colour Box's official World Cup thing, and it's far better.
And then finally, before the show actually closed in 1992, the final one was called Gold Crazy by Rod Argent, who was the rock star in his own right from the psychedelic scene of the 60s and 70s. I didn't know he'd written the football song, Zombies. He was She's Not There, Time of the Season. Then a group called Argent, which was his own formation. So, yeah, Rod Argent wrote Gold Crazy before the show would finally come to a conclusion in 1990, before finding new life as a nostalgia trip for middle-aged men, or yep. even stretching it into seniority men.
Yeah, for about OAPs, yeah.
So it goes on. And, you know, another season now, 1980-81 on ITV, plenty more material yet where that came from. If you're interested in any kind of history, actually, I'd say it's a social history as much as it is a football history when you look around it, you know, the attitudes and the...
And I'll tell you what, it has got a rare piece of footage from football history, I would say. It's an amazing game. And the reason why they say that was because ITV cameras, and I think it was Yorkshire Television, actually captured Pat Cuff keeping a clean sheet.
Very rare event.
2-0, yeah. And he actually made some stupendous saves. And, yeah, I am not lying. And, yeah, there you go. So, yeah. Joking aside, it is a capsule, you know, and anyone that watched the big match or match of the day, but particularly the big match, probably straight afterwards, got their Sabutio set out, set it up, and played Sabutio for the rest of the day.
It developed, for me, I sound a bit romantic now, listeners, but it developed a love of the game because, you know, there was no live football. Rare. I mean, you had the England-Scotland game at the end of the season and obviously the FA Cup. Maybe once every 4 years you might get to see a World Cup or some other big match, a European Championship perhaps once in a while. But there was no live football. And so you lived for the scraps that would come your way. And that would be if you could sit up late enough on a Saturday night match of the day. But more probably it's going to be Sunday afternoon watching the big match. And the thanks to the big match, I think, certainly for my generation, that was how a love of the game and a kind of a knowledge of the game developed, really. And I'm just looking at some of these fixtures on this series. They've got a whole list of the series on Wikipedia here. But, I mean, you've got games, like you said, Leighton Orient getting beaten by Manchester United. When does Leighton Orient ever feature on television nowadays? Southend beating Charlton. You know, clubs that would not normally feature in the modern scene. And also, I think because there was a rarity to television back then, you took notice in a way you probably don't. There's somehow more coverage to these days, and yet you watch less.
Yeah, I mean, you've even got, you know, things like Billy Bremner playing for Old City kind of thing as his career wound down. And then they'd have snippets from overseas, you know, you did play, especially, you know, frozen pitches, you know, you get the odd Scottish game thrown in or you get a game from the Bundesliga or they'll go to the ASL. So, you know, they had open horizons. But the one thing that has struck me is the amount of time they talk about how, you know, managers and footballers really want to put an end to the dour game and bring back entertainment, et cetera, and stuff like that. And I think, you know, people, I think, forget the beauty of just, you know, rocking up to a football stadium, you know, taking in the game, you know, as part of your weekend. You know, now it's kind of, you know,
you've got to make an effort for it in a way you didn't have to. But I actually did the Addicts a disservice. I think I said they lost. They actually beat Southend United on this footage. So if you're a Charlton fan, you want to see them win. Rare event nowadays. You can go and watch them beat Southend in the late 70s.
I think we can both say we're very, very sorry if you're a Charlton fan as well.
We feel your pain. Yeah. Different era. There were problems and there was simplicity that made it beautiful. And certainly for me, and I'd imagine for yourself, Neil, it kind of made a love of the game that maybe otherwise wouldn't have been there, but for this kind of coverage. So this was our little tribute to the big match. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we did it, Neil. So a big thank you for joining me
today. You're welcome.
And a big thank you to you, listeners, for joining the Football History Podcast. This will go out as a separate thing to the Acton Mall. And no doubt we'll be back when we can consider another niche subject on the world of football. Once Neil and my fertile imaginations run right, we come up with another idea another day. But until then, from myself and from Neil Andrews, it's thank you for listening. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.